to have it on the record. And today is June 18th, and we're here with Andrew Feldstein, who is CEO of Blue Mountain Capital. We view the work of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission in part as creating a historical archive and are reaching out to experts in various areas to talk about causes of the financial crisis and to try to be more analytic about that, to talk about causes and then propagating mechanisms, because there are different views on what the causes might be. And we were created by statute. We've held some hearings. We'll be holding some more hearings. Confidentially, the subject of derivatives, confidentially but unsurprisingly, will be the subject of one of those hearings. And the end result, aside from the archives, will be a report to Congress and the President by December 15th of this year. And we have limited people and time and resources in order to create that document. So we're reaching out to people who have good expertise.
Well, I'm flattered that I am on the list.
Given that I've given you some questions, I would prefer open-ended, to start with the open-ended question of what do you view as the causes of the financial crisis, and were derivatives or credit derivatives part of that?
That's a really big question.
It is.
The cause of the financial crisis. My view is that the financial crisis, first and foremost, was caused by macroeconomic policies and other policies that kept interest rates too low for too long and encouraged excessive growth in the mortgage market and created incentives for investors to invest in ways that was less about doing credit analysis and more about optimizing around incentives that were created by regulation. So against that backdrop, you know, you ask about derivatives. So I'm going to say something that is really cliche, and you've heard it 1,000 times in 1,000 different ways, but I truly believe it, which is that derivatives are really powerful tools. And powerful tools can be used for good, or they can be used for ill. And I think that one of my great concerns about this post hoc inquiry into the financial crisis is that people are looking for scapegoats, and that the easy way out often is to scapegoat things like tools, which have on their own nothing good nor nothing bad about them other than the fact that they're tools that can be used. And there were some instances, I think, in the financial crisis where derivatives as tools, along with a lot of other tools and instruments, were used in a way that reinforced or your term, propagated the crisis. Sure.
Do you want to walk through that from your experience in greater detail?
Yeah, I think it's one thing that's really important for people to distinguish is I'm sorry, guys. We just had to open the door for a coffee and tea that was delivered for Kim and me.
Cream, two sugars.
On your way.
Virtual.
So I think it's really, really important to distinguish between different kinds of derivatives. And different ways to distinguish between different kinds of derivatives, one way to distinguish them is the underlying asset class that they reference. And one form of derivatives references mortgages as an underlying asset class. And everything about the mortgage market was the technical term, insane. And that you know, underwriting standards got insane. The way that home loans were structured got insane. The way that mortgage-backed securities were created and structured got insane. And by the way, you know, derivatives associated with all those products got insane too. That's less a comment about derivatives, I think, and more a comment about the mortgage market. So as one of the parts of the mortgage market that contributed to the financial crisis, I would list derivatives along with underwriting standards and loan structures and mortgage-backed securities, et cetera. I think there are lots of other kinds of derivatives if you're categorizing them by asset class. The credit derivatives is a very popular whipping boy. And the I think that a lot of people get mixed up between mortgage-related credit derivatives and corporate credit derivatives. And I think that corporate credit credit derivatives that reference companies that borrow money instead of mortgage loans, weren't nearly as big a part of the problem. You know, if that's all there had been in the world, we wouldn't have had the kind of problem that we had. So I would draw a very, very sharp distinction between mortgage derivatives and other kinds of credit derivatives. You know, we forget a lot of times, those of us who are very focused on the credit markets, that credit derivatives are just a fraction of the derivatives markets. There's obviously a very big interest rate derivatives market, the foreign exchange market, equity derivatives market, the commodities derivatives market. So the term derivative is a very broad term that encompasses a lot of different transactions, a lot of different underlyings, and there are some unifying themes. If you guys hear cheering in the background, it's because it looks like people are watching the World Cup out on the floor. I apologize for that. If it gets too loud, I'll go tell them to calm down.
They were cheering for your commentary, actually.
Yes, I'm sure. I think it's really important if we're going to have an honest and thoughtful dialogue about this. That you know, when we talk about the term derivative, we get a little more specific about what kinds of derivatives that we're talking about. And I think you know a lot of the questions and a lot of the inquiry, I think for the most part relates to mortgage derivatives and less so to other kinds of derivatives.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Feldstein, I can assure you that we're drawing those distinctions, and just because a loudmouth here or there out in the blogosphere is demagoguing certain aspects of the derivatives market doesn't reflect on the whole debate. And so we are trying to be very precise in what we're looking at and what we don't. But in terms of your point that there were other non-mortgage-related credit derivatives in the derivatives market that were of interest to me, I was wondering what you thought about the SEC investigation into the use of single-name corporate credit default swaps to trade on non-public information.
You know, I'm not, and this is going to sound terrible because I'm obviously a big participant in the market, I'm not all that familiar. I mean, I know the SEC looks into things like that. I'm not all that familiar with the particulars of their investigation. I can say that as a philosophical matter or as a an economic matter, I believe very strongly that derivatives ought to be subject to the same sort of strictures that other securities are with respect to the securities laws. You know, I think that one of the things that makes markets successful markets is a fair playing field. And to the extent that derivatives, whether they be credit derivatives or any other kind of derivative, is somehow outside of the bounds of the securities laws, you know, I think that's a historical relic that exists because those derivatives weren't around when the original securities laws were passed. And then there was a sort of ad hoc approach over the years to how they got regulated. And my understanding is that's, you know, in all likelihood going to be remedied by, you know, the financial legislation that's pending. So, you know, my hope as a both a pretty big participant in the market and just as somebody who has, you know, like all of us, a big stake in the U.S. capital markets working right. My hope is that it won't be surprising in the future if we hear the SEC. It'll be, you know, we'll be disappointed that people violated the rules, but it won't be a big deal that the SEC is trying to apply securities laws to derivatives. They should be covered like other kinds of instruments.
Right, but it's another example of how they're a tool, and in this case, used for an inappropriate purpose. I was wondering also in terms of not just the derivatives and the related to credit risk on mortgages, but again, broadly through the OTC derivatives markets, what your views were about the use of collateral to secure those transactions, both before and during the crisis.
Well, normally when people ask that question, they're referring to AIG.
I'm not normal. Ask me to specify it if you want, but I'm dying to know what you think.
With respect to collateral, and I don't have a real organized answer, so I'm going to try to off the cuff divide it into three categories. I think having issues which need to be addressed, and some that work pretty well. Let's start, even though maybe it wasn't the main thrust of your question, because I'm so used to answering it from other people. Let me start with the AIG collateral. The AIG collateral arrangement was not a normal collateral arrangement. It was not typical of active participants in the market. What we all know about the AIG, we know a couple things about the AIG collateral agreement. The first is it was springing. That is, there was some period when there was no collateral required, and upon a downgrade of AIG, then collateral would be required. And any kind of contingent liability like that, because that's what it is, it was, you know, a contingent liquidity liability, is, I don't know that it's per se bad. My concern about those things is when they're opaque. And so there was this bilateral arrangement between two counterparties that contained a potentially very big, and as we saw, it turned out to be very big, contingent liability. Contingent liabilities don't bother me all that much. The problem is the market didn't really know about it. And if we want the market to work well, and that is apply the right prices to the right kinds of risks, then the market needs to know about things. And so my issue with that kind of springing liability is that it wasn't known by other market participants, and it really mattered, or it would have mattered, had other market participants known that it existed. It might have changed the price that they were willing to pay for things. So that's my thoughts on the big AIG issue, which was springing collateral. There was another, issue related to AIG, but I'll put this into my second category. I think it's a lot broader, and that is the AIG I shouldn't say the AIG derivatives, because AIG did lots of derivatives, and many of them were not like this. But you know, the ones that we all know about, they get all the press. were what's known as bespoke. Is that, have you guys heard that term before?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. So non-standardized, tailored. And the one of the issues that arises with respect to bespoke transactions and collateral is that often there's not a real good sort of market reference point for the value. And, you know, sometimes the parties have very good contractual agreements documenting how things will be valued, in which case, you know, normally big problems don't arise. But sometimes it's not all that well documented, or, you know, a lot of sort of discretion is resides in one of the counterparties to the trade. And, you know, circumstances change, people change in their jobs, et cetera. And all of a sudden you find there's a big disagreement about the amount of collateral that's owed. And again, one of the problems with big disagreements about the amount of, it should be obvious. When there are big disagreements about valuation, and those disagreements have impact on the amount of money that one counterparty owes to the other, it can have really significant consequences, both, you know, for the liquidity of the counterparties in question. And for the market, if the market is unaware that kind of dispute could arise, there's a theme that you're going to probably get sick of as you talk to me, which is I'm a big believer that if the market knows things, prices will adjust to discipline market participants. One of the problems with the kind of collateral arrangement I just described is the market doesn't know that there could be this big dispute or this big disagreement. And so the market can't discipline, can't adjust, can't set the right prices. The other thing that happens in very big...
Mr. Feldstein, do I understand you that you think the prices on credit derivatives should reflect not just the creditworthiness of the referenced entity, but the creditworthiness of the counterparties? Is that what you want to have happen?
That wasn't what I meant.
Would the market knowing about this springing collateral arrangement affect prices for the credit derivatives that AIG is trading?
Yeah, so maybe all prices in the market of all instruments should reflect potential liabilities of the underlying company. So that's not a comment about credit derivatives per se, although credit derivatives are one of those instruments whose prices should reflect it. It's a comment about equity prices. It's a comment about loans. It's a comment about bonds. All things that are traded in the market should reflect information about potential liabilities of the in public markets. I mean, I'm not talking about private markets, but you know, in public markets, the prices of all those instruments, not just credit default swaps, should reflect the important information, material information about the company. And so, do I think that springing liabilities is material information? If it can be really big, yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay, I agree. I'm thinking also an example of take your vanilla interest rate swap market. There they build in a credit spread over Treasury because that reflects the credit risk, the counterparty credit risk in the market. However, usually we don't think of that market as pricing the individual counterparties, but rather the kind of group or interdealer average counterparty risk.
You know, honestly, I'm not really understanding your question too well. So, interest rate swaps, they trade. You know, interest rate swaps are a spread over Treasuries. You're correct. What drives interest rate swaps? You know, part of it people think is bank credit, but that's not everything that drives interest rate swaps. There's a whole lot of technical factors, including people's hedging needs and the mortgage market and all sorts of other stuff. There have been times very recently, for example, where, believe it or not, swap spreads were below Treasury spreads. I'm not exactly sure what you're asking, I guess.
Well, the distinction between, you're right, in addition to the credit spread of the dealers, the interest rate swap spread over Treasury is affected by other factors, such as corporate bonds being brought to the market or the cost of balance sheet rent or whatever you want to add into that equation. But in general, it reflects the kind of market price of credit risk in that interdealer swap market. However, if it starts reflecting, if it differs from one dealer to another, then you can't trade it in through the interdealer brokers. You're not getting a uniform market price.
In other words, so you're hypothesizing a situation which generally doesn't exist, where one dealer says the swap spread is 10 basis points, and another one says it's 40, and a third says it's 70. And you're saying that doesn't happen in the interest rate swap market.
Well, I would assume if it's traded through an interdealer broker, and it's blind traded, so you don't necessarily know who your counterparty is when you trade. So you must be kind of assuming everyone in the market's got the same counterparty risk, and you're not pricing.
So I think you're asking a different question. You're asking. I apologize. You may be conflating two issues. One issue is, let's assume that all counterparties are of the highest quality risk, credit risk. Let's assume all counterparties are backed by the U.S. government. Not a bad assumption at certain points in time. Your point is that where that is the case, then swap spreads would be identical, should be identical, no matter which counterparty you traded with, because there should be no differentiation for the credit risk of the counterparty. Because all the counterparties are of equal credit quality. I don't think that has anything to do with the interdealer broker market.
Well, this is why I think it did. If I could try to make my point more clearly, to talk to you about what I'm trying to distinguish is between, on one hand, yes, the transaction should reflect counterparty credit risk. On the other hand, if it reflects an individual firm's counterparty credit risk instead of the markets, then you're not going to get the same price discovery. And so you do get price discovery in the vanilla interest rate swap market with a credit spread off of Treasury. But those prices generally don't reflect the differential counterparty credit risk of individual dealers, because the mere fact that you can trade them through an interdealer broker means that all the dealers are being treated the same, because when you hit or lift a quote, then you don't know who you've transacted with until the name's given up after the trade.
So you can't
price in that difference.
Yeah, so I think that you're right, and I don't think it's just the interest rate swaps market. I think that same dynamic would be true in the standardized credit derivatives market, in parts of the equity derivatives market that are standardized. I think what that reflects is not a disregard of counterparty risk, but rather transactions that fall into my third category of collateral, which is relatively standardized, relatively liquid transactions that are subject to robust daily collateralization regimes where there isn't a lot of dispute about prices. And I think the reason that people are willing to trade, whether it's interest rate swaps or credit derivatives or equity derivatives or commodity derivatives or FX derivatives that are standardized and liquid without discriminating in price by the credit quality of the counterparty is because it happens in the case where those transactions fall into really robust collateral regimes. So you take a counterparty like Blue Mountain. When we trade an interest rate swap, we trade it at the same price that any dealer trades it. And when we trade a credit derivative, we trade it based upon the prices that we see on the screen. And when we trade it, they don't then change the price because our credit quality might be different from somebody else's. So you say they're crazy. Why would they do that? We're a hedge fund. We're not a big bank. And the reason is these kinds of products, people are very comfortable with the collateral regimes. When you are the putatively riskier counterparty, as you know we are, we don't believe that we're riskier. And our experience during the credit crisis, I think, bears that out. But when you're the putatively riskier counterparty, you have to post an additional kind of margin, which you're familiar with, which is called initial margin in the derivatives market or haircut in the cash markets. So they've got some amount of initial margin that covers them for big movements. And then we have daily exchange of collateral, and the way we negotiate it is two-way. So when the price of the trade moves in the dealer's favor, we send money over to them. And when the price moves in our favor, they send money over to us. And we and they are very comfortable that you know we have a very robust regime where we value all these instruments each day, and we reconcile the valuations of all these instruments, so we're not in disagreement. And then by the end of the day, by the time before the Fed wire closes, money gets moved. And so it's sort of a when you've got a regime, and it only works for certain kinds of instruments, right? Which is why I'd say it's the third category. It only works when the instruments are relatively standardized, when there's a relatively high amount of agreement about how they're going to get valued each day. Counterparties don't really discriminate in pricing based on credit quality because it's all about the margining regime. And so I guess this sort of closes the circle on the whole discussion of collateral. I would say that's my third category of collateral. You know, the first being springing collateral regimes, which I think, we need to think about and address some of the flaws of. The second being, bespoke transactions, where you don't have easy daily reconciliation of prices. But people try to make, sort of daily exchanges of collateral, but you can run into problems when there are disagreements. And the third, which, by the way, is, the 90% of the actual flow in the derivatives market, the more standardized liquid transactions where people are actually comfortable and confident with the margining regime. Now, I would say that when counterparties traded with AIG and those mortgage derivatives, they absolutely, had the opportunity, whether they did it or not, I don't know. I don't know what the prices were of the transactions that people did with AIG. But if they were smart, they certainly would have built in differentiated pricing for counterparty risk. And there would have been no way for anybody else to know whether they did or didn't build it in because it wasn't a standard product that was traded.
And it wouldn't have been reported anyway.
And it wouldn't have been reported.
I have to drop off. I've got an investor call that'll try to dial back in when it's over.
Yeah,
okay, David.
Okay, bye.
Yeah, I mean, I think reporting is, I'm in favor of reporting, so I don't mean this to, for a whole bunch of reasons, I'm in favor of reporting, but so I don't mean what I'm about to say as a reason to not report, but the fact is in that third category of derivatives, we knew where trades were printing, even though there was no reporting of transactions because we were trading. The way our business works is we get, I forget what the latest number is, I think it's 400,000 Bloomberg runs a day with prices on them. And we compute 110 million prices per day based on our Bloomberg runs. So we know whether dealers are standing up to their Bloomberg runs or not, and generally they do, or we don't do business with them anymore. So we know where things we don't need reporting to tell us where things are pricing. It's a market that's sufficiently liquid, every deal and standard. The kinds of products that we trade, it doesn't if we trade with JP Morgan or Deutsche Bank or Barclays or Credit Suisse, it's the same trade no matter what. And we know, they're sending us 10, 20, 30 Bloomberg runs a day each. So we don't need the reporting to know where things are being priced. Now, that being said, I'm in favor of reporting for a whole bunch of different reasons. I don't need it to know where things are priced, but I think that there's real systemic value, meaning reduction of systemic risk, the ability to do, I mean, think of how much easier this auditing process would be if we had, you know, data repositories. So I think there's a lot of good, and think of how much, you know, easier the regulator's job would be if we had reporting. So I think there's real good reasons to be supportive of trade repositories and reporting. But I don't think that sort of sophisticated market participants or active market participants in the standard end of the market need it to, I don't think it's going to make one bit of difference in my business day to day.
But you wouldn't know the price at which Goldman trades with AIG because of Goldman's dealer runs.
No, so let's distinguish between two kinds of transactions. The bespoke mortgage transactions, I have, not only do I have no idea where they traded with AIG. Let's take a five-year credit default swap on IBM. I guarantee you that, and I know that AIG was a sophisticated and active market counterparty, I guarantee you, I don't know that AIG and Goldman did a deal, a trade, but if you told me that they did, and you told me roughly what time of day they did it, I will tell you within a tenth of a basis point where they traded.
So you think AIG is getting the same dealer runs that you're getting?
On liquid standard derivatives, absolutely. Again, you've got to distinguish. I'm a little worried we're conflating different kinds of products.
No, I'm just asking you a question to be really clear about your answer, sir. I really don't mean any disrespect or difficulty here, but it does. You know, you're what you've told us that I very carefully have listened to and written down doesn't mean that everyone gets the same dealer runs. And I'm implicitly asking you, does everyone get the same dealer runs? Because without that, you know.
Everyone gets the same. I think active, sophisticated market participants all get the same dealer runs. So let me be really clear. The active, sophisticated market participants get the same dealer runs on standardized products.
Right.
That's all I'm saying. Some market participants like ourselves, 95% of what we do are in those standard products. I think when you move to bespoke products, and now you're talking about the kinds of... So let me just step back. AIG did a lot of standard products as well.
I know, we know. Maybe. Yeah.
I think when you move into the realm of these bespoke products, there's no such thing as a dealer run.
Right.
Randall, I have more, but if you want to continue.
Well, or? I had just one quick last question I wanted to ask Mr. Feldstein. How many other people like yourself do you think are these active, sophisticated participants, that is the sort of non-dealers that are in the dealer space, that are trading at the same price as the dealers? And by dealer, we're thinking, you know, the top, I don't know, 12... you know, international financial firms that are, you know, banks or broker dealers that we think of normally as dealers. How many kind of people like yourself do you think are in that space?
Well, one of the issues that reporting will address is that we'll all have a much more definitive source to answer that question, because I think it's a pretty valid question. It's actually something that will not only be useful for regulators, but useful for all of us who are strategizing about how to grow, shrink, move our businesses. So what I'm going to give you is just a guess, because there is no definitive source. If you're talking about derivatives broadly speaking, so interest rate derivatives, credit derivatives, equity derivatives, it's thousands. Probably not tens of thousands, so, you know, somewhere between 7,000 and 10,000. If you're talking about credit derivatives exclusively, which I surmise you might have been, you're probably talking about hundreds.
So if ICAP is...
I warn you, by quoting me on those statistics, we all run the risk that I'm wrong. I just have none of us have any real good idea.
Yeah, I understand that it's no one can know for sure. No one's omniscient enough to know that. And so, in other words, there's several hundred people trading through, I guess, what would it be, ICAP or GFI in the more standardized credit derivatives space?
So, your question was how many non-dealers were trading, right?
Uh-huh. Yes, sir.
So ICAP and GFI are really what we call interdealer brokers.
Right.
I'm not a customer to ICAP. I'm not a customer to GFI. You know, GFI connects J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs and Goldman Sachs and Barclays and Deutsche Bank, etc. They don't connect me to the dealers. All of my transactions, and I suspect, you know, all of the transactions of the other several hundred active sophisticated counterparties, you know, that we think might exist, they're all customer to dealer. They don't go through ICAP and GFI.
Okay. Well, how do you know you're getting the same prices through the interdealer runs that you would get through interdealer broker?
Well, first of all, I know what the prices are. So you mentioned 12 dealers. We actually trade with 25. And I know what the price that each of those 25 dealers, or I mean, it never is the case that all 25 make a price on the same thing at the same time. So let's say 15 of them. At any point in time, I know the price that 15 of those dealers will make, and I don't know just where they'll buy. I know where they'll buy and where they'll sell a given position. Because I have 15 of them, I'm pretty confident that I know where things trade in the interdealer market. Because if there were big discrepancies between what I'm seeing from the dealers and what's going on in the interdealer market, then somebody is making or losing a lot of money trading between customers and other dealers. Because we talk to all of the dealers, and because they give us, you know, pretty good information about where their prices are coming from and where their flows are coming from, and because it's a competitive market and it just stands to reason and logic, I'm pretty confident that I know that there's not a big difference between what's happening in the interdealer market and what's happening in the customer market, because those discrepancies would very quickly get driven out by some dealers making a lot of money and other dealers losing a lot of money, and we just don't see that happening.
Well, I could see where the prices you're observing through the runs would indeed define a range within the interdealer market, but it wouldn't necessarily represent the same spread. Like, they may have a tighter spread trading through IDB or GFI than they're showing on the runs.
And absolutely. Absolutely. So I guess it all depends on your degree of tolerance, right? So do we know that we pay transaction costs to the dealer? Sure. So we might, you know, let's suppose we wanted to buy protection, and the market that we saw from the dealers, the best offer, which is, you know, the term for somebody's price when they're selling you protection, was 100 basis points. And the best bid that we saw, that is how much somebody would pay us, was, let's say, 98 basis points. So we know that, you know, if we go and pay somebody 100 basis points a year to buy protection, that what they're going to try to do is they're going to try to hedge themselves, and they probably think they can hedge themselves at 98 basis points. And so we know that they're making money on it. Now, if they go, they don't want to go to the interdealer market. They want to go to another customer.
Right.
They want to sell me protection at 100, and then they want to go buy it from somebody else at 98. And then they can make 2 basis points. And, you know, in running our business, the transaction cost is a cost of doing business that we try to minimize, just like any other business tries to minimize its cost of doing business. And we're pretty good at it, or else we wouldn't be in business anymore. When the dealer does the same thing, its goal, like I said, is to find another customer so it can sell to me at 100 and pay 98 to the customer. If it gets forced into the inner dealer market because it can't find another customer, it's going to pay more than 98.
That's right.
Probably pay 99.
Right. They won't get the full bid-ask spread.
They won't get the full bid-ask spread. That's right.
Okay. No, this is great. I just wanted to clarify this. I don't mean to take up any more of your time. I know Kim has some important questions to ask you.
Just that there was a pause, Randall, and I didn't know if you were regrouping or had a longer list. I see you have some notes. Are there some things that you want to just talk about without prompting from a specific
I think we've gotten a lot of the things I wrote notes about. So we talked about the need to distinguish between mortgage and corporate derivatives.
I'd like to go back to that area, if you will, because I think the first step of distinguishing is just acknowledging that we need to think about it differently. But to plumb it to another level, if I can, one bigger question is when all of these mechanisms hedge developed, In your view, did that lead to more credit creation? Did it lead to more mortgages created? Did it lead to either more corporate credit or tighter corporate credit, lower spread corporate credit? Do you have a sense of that dynamic? Because the volume of credit derivatives grew a lot.
Yeah, one of the advantages of derivatives of any type, not just credit derivatives, is it allows market participants to deconstruct financial instruments into different risk particles, we'll call them, and then to redistribute those risk particles to other market participants who are more willing or able to bear those risks. So when derivatives are being used effectively, they increase the market's capacity to extend credit risk, to take interest rate risk, to take foreign exchange risk, because market participants who otherwise wouldn't take those risks are able to do so.
So just the point I'm making,
because derivatives have been able to deconstruct
that
instrument into these risk particles. Now, can it go too far? And can derivatives, like any other kind of financial instrument, contribute to too much debt? Of course. And, you know, I could say the same thing about bonds and loans and equities and any other kind of financial instrument. Bubbles are the result of people taking too much risk. And derivatives, for all their power and all their benefits, aren't exempt from being overused, just like any other kind of financial instrument.
So the related question of that is, given that bubbles do occur, was this bubble somehow greater and worse, which I guess we have to all acknowledge it was, as a result of some of the mechanisms of derivatives adding more fuel?
I think in the mortgage market, certainly. You know, I don't know if you guys have read Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short. He says it all. A lot better than I could say it. I think he's right. I think that was particularly true in the mortgage market. In the corporate credit market, undoubtedly, the existence, not just of credit derivatives, but of different kinds of financial innovations in corporate credit led to the increase of credit availability. And not just credit derivatives, but, CDO technology. Within CDO technology, and tell me if I'm starting to use acronyms. I think you guys are familiar. You don't need me to go through the basics. But, within CDOs, CLOs, corporate loan obligations, CSOs, which stand for collateralized synthetic obligations, which are basically CDOs of credit default swaps, CBOs, collateralized bond obligations. All of these innovations increased the supply of credit. Now, that's not a terrible thing. I mean, right now the country is yelling and screaming at the banks to extend more credit. And, the prudent extension of credit is the thing that allows an economy to grow, for smart people to get capital, so they can grow their businesses. If the market works well, it takes capital away from people who are using it in a dumb way. So the credit innovations in the credit market, including credit derivatives and CDOs, almost certainly increased the supply of credit availability globally. And so to that extent, yes, it contributed to, you talked about declining credit spreads. Anytime you increase the supply of something, you decrease the price of it. So yes, there was more supply of people willing to take credit risk as a consequence of these innovations, and that pushed credit spreads down. The structures in the corporate market were a lot better than the structures in the mortgage market. So if you look at the performance of things like CLOs and CSOs, they did fine. I mean, there were some short-term price dislocations because the world was in a panic. But if you look at their actual performance, they did great. And the reason is they were structured more intelligently. You are a CLO person. You know that there are some silly things about the rating agency rules and CLOs, but one really good thing about CLOs is there's this great matching of assets and liabilities. And they're not short-dated liabilities. The liabilities actually go as long as the assets go. Why did Lehman fail? Well, because its assets were a lot longer dated than its liabilities. CLOs were smarter than Lehman. So,
I wouldn't quote you on that.
So, you got me on tape. It was an overly pithy statement, but I think the big difference can we find a few exceptions? Sure, any market. Yeah, we will find some people who did some things that weren't so smart. But by and large, let's call it corporate structured credit, and say within that are corporate CDOs, broadly speaking. Corporate standardized corporate credit derivatives, even bespoke corporate credit derivatives, by and large, they were structured in a way that allowed them to survive the credit crisis pretty well intact from a fundamental basis.
So the problem is there was too much correlation in mortgages, and that was underestimated by most of the world.
That was a well. So there were two big problems. Number one. Number two, I don't know if this is a problem, but this is a difference. The size of mortgage derivatives relative to the size of the mortgage market was many orders of magnitude greater than the size of the corporate credit derivatives market relative to the underlying credit markets.
Do you have data on that?
I don't have data on that, but I know it exists.
I hadn't heard that before, and that's very interesting.
Well, just think about the way these. Think about Michael Lewis's book, right? And think about the way the mortgage market works and the way the corporate credit derivatives market works. So Lewis's book talks about people, and I don't mean to denigrate these people. I think they were genius, and I think they did some really good things for the market by exposing what was going wrong. I wish people had listened to them a lot earlier. But people who were shorting the mortgage market were picking the bonds that they wanted to short, and they were going to dealers and intermediaries and entering into contracts that shorted these securities. The way the mortgage market works is each mortgage security is a very unique security issued off of a very unique pool of mortgages. So the triple B rated security of some mortgage pool, of a $1 billion mortgage pool, might only be $50 million. And if somebody wants to short that 50, because that happens to be a really bad pool and a particularly poorly structured deal, if people all want to short that triple B security and you find 20 people who want to buy a $50 million short on it, you've now got $1 billion worth of shorts on a security that only has $50 million worth of underlying. Well, now think about the corporate market. The corporate market is very generic. When somebody buys or sells credit protection on, I'll pick on a name that nobody really has any concerns with, Walmart, okay? So I'm not saying anything in particular about Walmart. We all think Walmart's a great company and very sound. Walmart's got billions and billions of dollars of debt. It's all kind of similar. And the net outstanding credit, and you can actually go check this now on, at least in the standard liquid market, you can check this through DTCC. The net outstanding you've got to get them to give it to you, but you can get it. Regulators can certainly get it. The net outstanding exposure on Walmart is a fraction of Walmart's outstanding debt instruments. And it's the nature of the market. And so I suspect we are very minor participants in the mortgage derivatives market. So we're not going to be a really good source of information for you on the mortgage derivatives market. I suspect if you went to any of the large banks and said, can you please give me some information, or if you went to DTCC, who I don't know how much information they have on the mortgage market because so much is bespoke, but if you ask them to help you deconstruct the size of the mortgage derivatives market relative to the size of the underlying market as compared to the same ratio in the corporate market, I suspect what you'll find is that it's a much higher ratio in the mortgage market than in the corporate market. People don't trade mortgage derivatives anymore.
It's very interesting observation and insight, and we will try to do that. But if we move to to indices,
like credit indices, or
like
ABS,
we actually don't yet have volume information, although we're.
I think you should be able to get ABX and CDX volume information from DTCC.
They have it currently. The question is, do they have it historically?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think they do.
I thought that the volume of CDX is enormously larger.
Okay, so I need to be more precise in what I'm saying. The flow, the market volumes in corporate credit derivatives, much, much bigger than the market volume in mortgage derivatives. What I am referring to is the net outstanding positions. So there might be billions and billions of dollars. We can trade $1 billion of index in a day. But the net position that we get left at the end of the day, relative to any name inside the index, is close to zero. And that's because we're buying and selling the index, so even though lots of volume, the buys and the sells are offsetting each other. And we're buying and selling the names inside of the index, so even if we don't offset the index with another index trade, we're offsetting the risk of the names with all the single names. So at the end of the day, if you, and the the way to think about net exposure, I'm going to get, tell me if I'm getting too technical and complicated here. When you look at net exposure on DTCC, for example, you'll see that the net exposure of credit derivatives outstanding is like 10% or less of the gross exposure outstanding. Now, one thing about the derivatives market is for every buyer, there's a seller. So if you look on the at the highest level, there's no net exposure because, you know, if you net the short of the guy who sold it against the long of the guy who bought it, the net exposure in the market is zero. But what DTCC and the rest of us mean when we say net exposure is you look at the absolute value of the exposure to a single name by each counterparty. So if there was just one trade in the market and counterparty A sold protection to counterparty B, the net exposure would be the same as the gross exposure. But if counterparty B then hedged its position with counterparty C, you don't, counterparty B then drops out of the equation. And it's just the exposure of counterparty A and counterparty C. Am I being too confusing?
We get it.
Okay. So the if you look at the net exposure in the corporate market, it is much, much, much smaller relative to the outstanding amount of credit risk, underlying credit risk, bonds, loans, counterparty risk, et cetera, as opposed to in the mortgage market, where much more of the market was the intermediaries were buying protection from the end users. AIG wasn't running a hedged book. AIG was selling protection to everybody. AIG had a huge net position in mortgages. So the what I'm talking about is not the volumes, the daily trading volumes, much bigger in corporates than in mortgages. I'm not even talking about the gross outstanding. There's bigger gross positions in the corporate market than in the mortgage market. I'm talking about the net outstandings. I'm talking about people in the market who had a directional position to some underlying. And in the case of the, we know who are, you know, generally on the sides of the big net positions in the mortgage market. You had the big famous hedge funds who made a lot of money. Again, I'm not denigrating them. I think they provided a valuable service and were very smart. They had big net short positions. And we know who was on the other side. It was the AIGs of the world and the monoline. They had, and a couple of investment banks that, you know, kind of came to the game, and also had big short positions. So you had in the mortgage market, it was
big long positions.
Well, some had big long positions. Yes, I'm sorry. Some had big long positions, like say Citigroup or Merrill Lynch, and some had big short positions, like say Deutsche Bank and Goldman Sachs. And so you had many more players in the mortgage market who had big net directional positions. Whereas in the corporate market, although there's lots of trading and lots of volume, you got a lot of people like us. We can do 200 trades a day. Lots of trading, lots of volume. We can trade $1 billion a day. We're not left with big open positions, big net positions to any individual credit. And that, I think, that's what I'm trying to get at. It's not the volume in the market, not the gross amount of transactions. It's the net risk that's left open at the end of the day in the market. And am I sounding intelligent?
And completely clear.
Okay.
This may be asking the same question in different words, but allow me to do it anyway. The volume of speculation, I don't use that term pejoratively, just to distinguish from hedging, the volume of speculation grew with the volume of trading in derivatives, just factually. So the question then becomes, did just this increase in speculation in some way lead to, if not a cause, then part of the greater panic of what we experienced?
Well, I think we should be thankful that probably that the speculators caught on to the problem when they did, I think, if it had. So the speculators are not going to be the ones who are providing credit capacity to the markets. To provide credit capacity to the markets, you need to have somebody who's taking a net position. Right? If all that's happening is speculators are trading amongst each other, then there's no new credit capacity that's coming into the market. So AIG provided a lot of credit capacity to the mortgage market because it had a big net position, right? What speculators do in the ordinary course is they facilitate the movement of risks and positions in between market participants who have big net positions. And so speculators are kind of the grease in the wheels of the market. Sometimes speculators are also the ones who can either exacerbate market trends or pop bubbles. In this case, I don't think it was the speculators were exacerbating market trends. I think that the supply of credit into the economy, the thing that led to the bubble, were coming from end investors who were using all different kinds of products, credit derivatives, CLOs, CDOs, just plain bonds and loans, to generate returns in a low interest rate environment. And those were the AIGs of the world, and those were the monolines of the world, and you know they were in Michael Lewis's book, Dusseldorf. And so these were end investors. Now, they might not have been such prudent investors, and they might have been extending credit or taking other types of risk based on factors that, in hindsight they shouldn't have. Like, they cared a lot more about ratings than they cared about actually doing credit work. But at the end of the day, they were investors. And maybe not so smart, but they were investors. They weren't speculators. Where speculators played a pretty big role in the credit crisis, they were the ones who figured out that this whole thing was a house of cards. They profited when they figured it out. But I'll tell you, if they hadn't figured it out when they did, this thing could have gone for another 2 or 3 years. And the ultimate bursting could have been even, it's hard to imagine. But if it had gone on for a few more years, it could have been even worse.
We have heard this point of view from a number of other market participants, which is a very interesting view, trying to be noncommittal. I have a few more. I don't want to preclude my colleagues from asking questions, and I know we don't have tons more time. But I'll keep going unless you interject.
No, please go ahead.
Is there something inherent within the derivative mechanism that leads to less transparency in the system than when we had more cash instruments?
There's nothing inherent in derivative instruments themselves. And I think that some of the accounting rules related to derivatives need to be made more transparent. But that's an issue with accounting, not an issue with derivatives.
Would you mind speaking more to that?
I think that an investor ought to be able to open up the annual report of any large financial institution and have a very good understanding of what their exposures from derivatives are. You probably have, probably more than I do. Have you tried to read the financial reports of any major financial institution? And if you have, do you understand what the derivatives exposures are? Pure and simple. That's not a problem with derivatives. It's just the way they're accounted for.
Can you be more specific on how you'd like to see it approved?
Boy, I think it's a big task. I'm not an accounting expert. I don't think there is an easy answer, but I can tell you what the goal is, and it's very succinctly stated. I think that not the layperson, but a generally well-informed and experienced financial markets professional ought to be able to open up the financial statements of any public registrant and come away from it with the ability to explain and understand what kinds of exposures that company has relative to derivatives. And it should be market risk, and it should be liquidity risk, and it should be sufficiently specific that if AIG blows up because of mortgage derivatives, while people might say, well, I didn't think it was going to happen, they will also say, given what happened in the mortgage market and what I knew about AIG, that is what I would have expected to happen to AIG if the mortgage market blew up. And you couldn't, you still can't do that. Again, that's got nothing to do with derivatives. That's just got, yeah, derivatives, the accounting rules don't work right with respect to derivatives.
That may be true with regard to
lots of other things.
Other structured
loans. I'm not sure loans are accounted for the right way. So that's not, that's absolutely, I think that, it's really hard. I mean, it's easy for me to sit here and say, fix the accounting rules. I'll tell you, it's not the easiest thing in the world to do. And, there's a lot of vectors operating on this. There's, people are trying, clearly, and it's complicated and it's not easy to do. Yeah, there are vested interests and all different kinds of vested interests including in the official sector, in the private sector, investors, issuers. Everybody's got sort of a different dog in the hunt in terms of wanting to influence accounting rules to tell the kind of story they want to tell. And it's really hard, and I don't have real easy answers, except to say it's not easy. And, I think somebody, and I'm sure, I know I'm not the first person to say this, and I'm not even the most articulate person to say this, and I'm not the most knowledgeable person to say this, so I'm just adding fuel to other people's fire, I know. But I don't think it makes it any less true. We got to fix the accounting rules, and if we want to bet on markets being the best regulator, then we got to let markets be markets, and markets can't be markets if they're not transparent. And I would say that applies in the case of derivatives. I would say it applies in the case of structured products. I mean, it applies in the case of this silly, this thing that banks do, where, at the end of each quarter, they, do this little transaction that reduces their leverage by 40%, and then 2 days later, they put it back on. What's that about? I mean, that's got nothing to do with derivatives. It's just the rules are wrong. You can't understand about a company if it's allowed to do that. And we got to fix all that stuff. Or the markets can't discipline anybody. The markets can't make good decisions. And when the markets don't make good decisions, you get bubbles that explode. Right. The end of my philosophical proselytizing.
I want to go back to a couple things just almost clean up. You said a lot. You spent a lot of time with us. We appreciate it very much. Towards the beginning of our conversation, you said something about, and forgive my poor paraphrasing, that there was a lot of activity that was less about credit analysis and more about optimizing regulatory, I don't know if you said capital or just regulatory.
Well, it's rating. So, I was referring to the use of ratings to supplant risk-based decisions. And I take it by that chair that USA is doing something really well out there. You can just look at that. Look at that. This is not going to be a risk.
Yeah.
So we're looking out the window of my office, and my entire firm is clustered around the television. 100 people are not working. They're watching the television. So the ratings. You know, I think one of the, again, this, I am going over ground that is very well trotted, and where you're going to get people who know a lot more about this than I do, and who have thought much more deeply about the right kinds of solutions. It is obvious, and it's obvious to you guys, and it's obvious to those of us who participate in the market, that a lot of market participants used ratings to make decisions instead of common sense and fundamental analysis. And the reason they did it was because of things like capital regulations that were based on ratings. They were based on market protocol or sort of market acceptance of, you know, the commercial paper market. If you were A1, P1, then you could sell paper because the SEC said that was acceptable, and if you're A2, P2, you can't. How do you get to be A1, P1? You buy AAA-rated securities. So it, there was this whole complex, and it still exists, and we know it, that places this really great value on ratings, and the, in particular, where ratings are very rules-based, you know, one of the big differences, you know, a lot of people wonder, well, why is it that the rating agencies generally do okay? I mean, they may not be the best, but no one's really complaining about how rating agencies rate corporates. And they do from time to time. They made a mistake on Enron. They made a mistake on WorldCom. But by and large, not all that concerned, you know, other than some modifications at the edges about how ratings agencies rate corporates. Why is it that in structured finance there was all this problem? To me, it's really, really an easy answer. There's a lot more subjectivity and a lot less very specific rules that agencies use to rate companies. But when it comes to rating structured finance, there are these rules and models. And once the really smart people at the investment banks figure out the rules and the models, they're subject to arbitrage. So you can't arbitrage a corporate rating. There's no rules and there's no models to be arbitraged. Really smart people are going to figure out how to arbitrage specific rules and models, especially when they can outgun the ratings agencies because they have more profit, they're more, you know, higher prestige place to work, all those reasons that we all know about. So that's what I was referring to earlier. And, you know, I think that I agree with a lot of people, and, you know, I've seen testimony. I didn't see the, your commission's ratings agency testimony, but I saw, I think, both the Senate and the House, and there's some really smart people, and it's like Frank Partnoy out, from the University of San Diego, and this guy from New York University. They're really good, and they talk about how, so much of the power of ratings comes from their official sanction. And, it, you know, it's ratings determine capital. So, of course, people are going to try to game ratings because it determines capital. But that's by regulation. You know, ratings determine permissible investments, you know, because of SEC rules. Of course people are going to try to game it because there's power that you get from the regulatory complex. So, you know, I think that the things that those guys say are really smart, and it's mostly about you got to reduce the impact of ratings because that'll take away the value of trying to arbitrage them.
Okay, Greg, this is my last subject and question, I think. And we've talked a little bit about leverage, but I just want to go back to derivatives and leverage. Is there something inherent in how derivatives are structured that allow for greater leverage to build up in the system, which then in a bubble becomes more troublesome?
Similar to prior answers, the way they're used, two points. Number one,
I'll hold
without good collateral
about machines, leverage.
Absolutely. Most active participants, like ourselves, are subject to and require of our counterparties robust collateral regimes that prevent derivatives from becoming so over-leveraged. But where derivatives aren't subject to sensible collateral regimes, as in the case of AIG, then they are a good way to take leverage. Not a good way. They are an effective way to take leverage. There's a bigger problem, I think. Gets back to my accounting issue. Leverage, if leverage per se isn't horrible, and so long as the market knows how leveraged a company is or how leveraged a market participant is, the market is going to discipline that participant. They will charge more money for lending the marginal dollar to that market participant. They'll be more cautious of that participant when entering into commercial transactions. All kinds of things will happen. And if the market believes with full information that that participant can manage its leverage well, that participant will be allowed to keep leveraging itself. If the market is concerned, then it won't. The biggest problem with leverage arises when the market doesn't know. And so I think AIG is a good example. The market didn't know that AIG had this massive potential exposure to the mortgage market. Not only did the market not know it had it on a fundamental basis, they didn't know it had this springing collateral that could cause this huge liquidity crisis. If the market had known, I think the market would have priced things differently. It's not just derivatives, though. This example of the banks playing around with their balance sheet every quarter. They're feeding incorrect information to the market. And I think that for all of, generally, if the market, we should insist that the market gets accurate information about leverage. Whether that leverage comes from repo, or that leverage comes from derivatives, or that leverage comes from a loan, the market should know. And then the market can, at least, I believe that lots of imperfections, lots of flaws with markets, regulation is needed, but by and large, I haven't seen anything that works better at setting prices and allocating resources. It won't work if it doesn't get the right information. And so a lot of the problems, and again, it's not just derivatives, although the problem relates to derivatives as well as to all the other things we're talking about. A lot of the problems are that the markets aren't allowed to be markets. They're not getting the right information.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
My colleagues, do you have anything further?
I'm keeping it to an hour and a half. I very much appreciate that.
Well, in ten minutes. Oh, okay. I guess I would like to just ask quickly. I mean, you said the Michael Lewis book tells the whole story, but one of the things we're trying to figure out
in the mortgage market, it tells it very well.
In the mortgage market, but I guess we've kind of got these theories about how important CDOs were, which we're examining. And if you have any view on this, I mean, for example, a lot of folks say that there wouldn't have been a mortgage-backed security market the way there was if there wasn't the demand from CDOs for the triple B tranches. And then similarly, they say, and CDS was pretty important there too. I mean, so one of the questions really is, to what extent did that mechanism contribute to the bubble?
I think in the mortgage market, with the caveat that we are a relatively minor participant in the asset-backed market generally, and even within our asset-backed activities, we're not that big of a mortgage participant. We're much bigger in consumer and in equipment asset-backed. So you're going to get sort of probably more expert analysis from people who were or are more substantially involved in the mortgage market itself.
Mm-hmm.
But I would agree that in the case of the supply of mortgage credit,
mm-hmm.
While there certainly were a lot of factors that started the snowball rolling and got it pretty big,
mm-hmm.
Starting from government policy around Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, interest rate policy, tax deductibility, all kinds of stuff you can point to. But leading into declining underwriting standards, a misalignment of interest between the originators and the end investors, ratings agency arbitrage, and yes, ultimately CDOs were part of that snowball.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's, look, and again, I'm not, you got to talk to people who are more intimately involved in the mortgage market than we were. My best guess is that CDOs made the snowball bigger. Mm-hmm. And then maybe they made the snowball roll a little faster. Mm-hmm. So when it ultimately hit the wall, it hurt a little more. But I think that snowball was coming down the mountain no matter what. And it would have hit the wall no matter what. And so it's, it's an issue of degree, not necessarily direction.
Okay. I think Linda, do you want to ask a question?
We've also read Jillian Tett's book. Was there anything, which of course talks about you and history?
How did she describe me? Like the geeky.
I disagree with that. Yeah, she got that wrong.
Yeah.
But is there anything.
Socially awkward geek or something like that?
Is there anything more substantive that you think is somehow misleading that you'd want to correct?
In Jillian's book, I think Jillian did a pretty good job, notwithstanding her characterization of me as a socially awkward geek. She described a time and a culture pretty well, I thought.
Okay. So, Greg?
Landon?
Yeah. Mr. Feldstein, we're interested in hedge funds. Could you briefly describe the world as it looked from your point of view with respect to your prime brokerage relationships and perhaps redemption requests you may have received during the various liquidity crises?
Yeah, so our main prime broker is J.P. Morgan, and we have we use other prime brokers as well, but they're our biggest one, and we have a collateral and margining regime with Morgan that it's incredibly protective to them. I think they never felt at all concerned about us throughout the crisis. The amount of margin that they had relative to the price movements in our portfolio, the margin covered the price movements by a factor of several times. We also have to be very good in terms of managing our own liquidity. So in addition to the margin that we had posted at our prime brokers, we held a lot of cash. And the amount of cash that we held covered the price movements in our portfolio, I think the never less than a factor of 3-1. So, we were, from a liquidity standpoint, vis-a-vis our counterparties and our prime brokers' confidence in us, at least with respect to our main prime broker, J.P. Morgan, felt pretty comfortable throughout the crisis. We think that J.P. Morgan behaved incredibly sensibly, honorably, thoughtfully. I don't think they did anything imprudent with respect to us or others, and I think that's reflected in their performance. I mean, they obviously were one of the institutions that came out of this quite well. We saw that day in, day out in our interactions with them. So, I would say that from if I were a shareholder of Morgan, a creditor of Morgan, or a customer of Morgan, I think I'm all three, I give them really, really high marks. I think that you hear all kinds of stories about hedge funds who had bad experiences with their prime brokers, whether it was about valuation disputes or about abruptly changing margining regimes, prime brokers trying to squeeze them out of positions. I hear, you guys probably hear more stories than I do about that, and I can, I'm sure many of them are true, but I can tell you that is just the opposite of the experience that I had with J.P. Morgan.
I see. Without divulging any proprietary information, could you give us an idea or an overview or perhaps a brief classification of your trading strategies?
Sure. Now, I am going to have to run pretty quickly.
We've reserved only till noon.
My risk meeting is at noon. I'm going to have to go to that. But we're very active participants in the credit markets. I'd say about 80% of what we do is in the credit markets. The balance is in the equity markets. And, you know, we're not real big directional players. We don't take big bets on, the market going up or market going down. Our goal is to make money no matter what. We trade across, one of the reasons that we make money, I think, is that we're instrument agnostic. So we look for the... we look to buy the cheapest risk regardless of what instrument it shows up in and sell the most expensive one, regardless of the instrument it shows up in. So a lot of our strategies, are about when the index is cheap versus all of its constituents, we buy the index or we sell the names. We call that index arbitrage. When a secured instrument is cheap relative to an unsecured instrument by the same company, we'll buy the secured instrument and we'll sell the unsecured instrument. We call that capital structure. When bonds trade at spreads that are different from the spreads of the underlying CDS, we'll buy the bond and short the CDS. We call that bond basis. And all of those sort of... sort of relative value or arbitrage-like strategies make up about half of what we do. The other half of what we do is just fundamental credit picking. So we go long credit instruments of companies that we think have improving credit fundamentals, and we go short companies that we think have, at least on a relative basis, deteriorating credit fundamentals. We're really diversified, a lot of hedge funds will tell you, these are my three big ideas and we'll make lots of money if any of these come true. We can't really do that. At any point in time in our long-short business, we've got about 75 different trades strategies going on. We're very instrument agnostic in our long-short business. If we like a company and its loan is cheaper than its bonds, we'll buy the loans. Or if its default swap is cheaper than its bonds and its loans, we'll buy the default swap. So, instrument agnosticism. The other thing that, the reason that I think we've been successful in all of our strategies, but I think this is maybe particularly true of credit long short, is really, really, people don't realize this, but, if you add up all of the non-sovereign credit risk in the world from bonds and loans and counterparty exposures and lease exposures, it's probably three times the size of the public equity markets. But when you go and you look at the number of, say, hedge funds who are involved in equity markets versus the number of hedge funds that are involved in credit markets, no definitive source for this, but we think it's probably 5-1 in favor of equity funds. So you got a much bigger market. It's got much more richness and diversity and attributes. So, common stock is kind of economically fungible from the same issuer. But bonds, you've got different maturities, different coupons, different security packages, different currencies, floating rate, fixed rate. So there's this rich diversity of attributes in the credit market, in addition to a rich diversity of issuers. Whereas in the equity markets, you've got a rich diversity of issuers, but not a rich diversity of attributes. So you've got a bigger market with richer diversity and fewer absolute return managers going after it. We think that's really where one of the big advantages comes for us.
And good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time. That was very helpful.
I very much, and I say this, I know some people probably say this cynically, I actually say this completely honestly and sincerely. I really look forward to reading your report.
Well, that puts a lot of pressure on. Can I ask just, could you give us a name of one or two people you think maybe might be valuable for us to call? Or if you can't think of that right now, just it would be great to just reach out and let Kim know because we're always looking for
Have you talked to Michael Lewis? I don't know the guy. I've never...
We have.
Yeah, I think we have.
As well
we
have, as...
I, He has this
some of the characters in his book.
Look, to me, the bubbles come and bubbles go. We had an internet bubble, you know, we had a savings and loan bubble, we had all kinds of bubbles. The really painful part of this was the mortgage market. And it was the mortgage market that got insane and that got crazy. And he is, and I've read, I mean, you can turn around and you can look at all, those are the books I haven't read yet about the financial crisis. So Kim's looking at my bookshelf. I've probably read, you know, more than that, that are at home. I take them home after I read them. Lewis's book is by far and away the best. He's just got this knack for, you know, being able to understand things and explain them in a way the rest of us can understand. So I'm glad you talked to him. And, yeah, I would talk to the people in his book. John Paulson, it wasn't featured in Lewis's book, but, you know, he's obviously somebody who figured it out early on.
Okay.
I'm a bit envious. We didn't. We weren't as smart as they were.
Okay. Great. Okay. Well, thanks very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Good luck.
Bye-bye. Bye.